It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher tells us why big political donors sometimes end up with jobs as U.S. ambassadors and why that might hurt the nation's foreign policy goals. First, access to affordable housing is a growing challenge for some Wisconsinites, not just the homeless, but also low to middle income working people or senior citizens on fixed incomes. A report earlier this year from the Wisconsin Realtors Association found that housing costs have outpaced inflation and incomes over the last decade, resulting in a shortage of what they call workforce housing, homes that are affordable for people who make up the labor force in a given area. Two state lawmakers join us now in the studio. Janet Bewley is a Democrat representing the state's 25th Senate district, including Bayfield, Ashland, and Washburn counties. She sits on the Senate Committee on Utilities and Housing and is a board member of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, or WEDA. Senator Bewley, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And Scott Allen is a Republican representing the state's 97th Assembly District, which includes Waukesha. He's also a board member with WEDA and vice chair of the Assembly Committee on Housing and Real Estate. Representative Allen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Representative Allen, let's start by talking to both of you, actually, about what's happening in your part of the state. You represent the Waukesha area. Do you see access to housing that people can afford being an issue there?
It's a huge issue. We have plenty of jobs available in Waukesha County, but not enough workers. And the workers, you know, we have a disconnect between workers and housing is what we have in Waukesha County. So there's transportation issues related to it. Housing could be an important solution to that.
And Senator Bewley, take us to northern Wisconsin. What do you see up there?
Well, northern Wisconsin is usually challenged by the lack of developers who see the area as a place where they want to get involved and get investment. Also, we have a very diverse area. Some of the areas are not settled densely at all. Very, very rural. Houses are far apart. And then we also have cities, the city of Superior, the city of Rice Lake. And they all have different needs. Some have a lack of older housing options for the elderly or those on fixed incomes. Some of the cities say we need that middle market. Others say we need market rate for the up-and-comers who are moving into the area. So it's a complex problem, but that's what we hope to find are complex solutions.
Is there something that the state can do, given that it doesn't sound like there's a one-size-fits-all approach? There are specific problems that are different in the biggest cities to the rural communities. Senator Bewley, starting with you, do you see the state having a role here in helping tackle this?
Well, I think that the fact that we do have agencies that are doing things very well for specific markets, and that is WEDA, Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, their target market is those people who are on fixed incomes and low incomes, because the programs that they are able to do bring in subsidy to keep those rents low. And we have a mortgage product meant for first-time home buyers that will keep the interest low, lower than the market, and also give them the guidance they need to buy their first home. But the first home to buy is becoming rarer and rarer. The housing stock in northern Wisconsin is very old, some of the oldest homes in the state. So we need the ability to build. Building is hard, and we just can't renovate everything, and not everybody wants to do that. So we need a mix of solutions for a mix of problems.
And Representative Allen, what do you want to add to that as far as what the state can do to tackle these things?
Yeah, it's challenging because so much of our land use decisions are made at the local level, and it's the local land use regulations that greatly impact the supply of housing. Oftentimes, we have very restrictive zoning laws. We have very sometimes steep fees that are involved. Sometimes the development approval process is very cumbersome. That all makes the potential for housing development tougher and tougher. Because, you know, a developer is going to go where things are easy. A developer is going to go where the potential profits are greater. And so they're going to look for the low hurdles and the easy profits. So I think we as a state have to really examine how we can, you know, potentially influence those local land use decisions and those local lawmakers to be more developer-friendly, to encourage more housing development in places like Senator Bewley's district or all around the state.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I think that this is interesting because northern Wisconsin, we have the land. We have communities that are ready to work with developers. We've made the process as simple as we can, and yet they won't come because, one, they don't have the guarantee that the projects are going to work, that these houses are going to sell or the units are going to rent, because right now it is a free market. There is no subsidy involved, or there is no group of people that are getting a lower rate or a cheaper mortgage unless you do target low-income people. The other problem is that we have a lack of attractive development frills, the things that bring people into the area. With the property taxes having been frozen for as long as they have, communities have not been able to invest. They can barely get the roads plowed. And with the weather as it is, the culverts and from the flood, there are so many expenses that local communities have. They can't build parks. They can't build water parks. They can't add more library hours. They can't do the kinds of things that are very important to people who move in. And, of course, we have the problem with lack of broadband. High-speed internet is a requirement, but we still have large areas that do not have it.
Talking about affordable housing in Wisconsin with two state lawmakers, Senator Janet Bewley, a Democrat, and Scott Allen, Republican, in the Assembly. Representative Allen, are there ways to help local communities out here to give them flexibility to tackle these problems without, I guess, the state overriding their ability to control what's going on in their neighborhoods?
Right. You know, you can look at it from a standpoint of a carrot and a stick, right? I think everybody responds to incentives better than the punishment. I think we have to put everything on the table because we do have, I don't want to call it a crisis, but it's, I think, approaching an affordable housing crisis in Wisconsin. It's not quite there yet, but we have to be creative. We have to reexamine. So many of our zoning codes, for instance, all across the state, were largely put in place in the 1950s and have remained largely unchanged since. I challenge anybody to look at their local zoning code, pick any particular zoning definition, and read what the requirements are and see if you can figure out what you could actually build in those locations. So I think we have to look at a way of, if we're going to encourage developers to move around the state to go to different places, if there's any way that we can, to some extent, universalize zoning codes so that a developer from Dane County could look at a neighboring county and not be intimidated by the process, because it is a long time. There's a lot of money invested up front in a development process. Also, when you talk about development, one of the things that gets in the way is quite frankly, the banking regulations, the Dodd-Frank regulations, make it almost impossible for developers to invest in land speculation these days. That's a federal government regulation, but are there things that we can do on a local economy basis? Some of the things that have been done in other states are what are called public improvement districts, where we look at the streets and the sewers and the gutters and the all that stuff and financing that separately outside of the development. Maybe there's creative ways we can structure it so that communities could utilize those tools. So we've got to add more tools to the toolbox to make it easier for municipalities to do the kinds of things that will attract development.
And Senator Bewley, we've talked on the show about cities around the country looking at this idea of a lot of zoning being single family and only single family and this much distance between single family houses and trying to loosen things up to allow either multifamily developments, a small apartment, say, or even just allowing, you know, renting that back outbuilding or the shed above the garage or whatever. Is this an issue here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it is from community to community, because I know that there are, I'll take the city of Superior, there already are row houses, zero lot lines, and there are communities that are ready to have that. And also, a number of people who really like that style of living, having the alley be the main way that you navigate your neighborhood with an attractive front yard, leads to all kinds of very, very nice development plots. But again, these decisions are made locally. If there would be something that the state could do to help redefine what the different zones are, how they're labeled and what is required, the ability to get a change in zoning is pretty much up to the local level. And I believe that more education about the importance of having an approachable government that will make the zoning changes more easy and more appropriate for the kind of development that the community needs.
We're talking to Democratic State Senator Janet Buley and Republican State Representative Scott Allen about the issue of affordable and workforce housing in Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever felt priced out of housing where you live? Is that your situation right now? You can't afford to rent or buy a place close to where you work? Do you think housing costs are taking up too much of your income? What would you like to see the state do to help out, or your local government for that matter? Do you have questions for our guest or ideas for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Republican State Representative Scott Allen and Democratic State Senator Janet Buley. We're talking about affordable housing in Wisconsin for people at a variety of income levels, issues with finding places for people who work to live in their own communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a problem for you in your community? High rents, high costs of housing. Have you personally felt priced out of housing in your area? What kind of solutions do you want to see? What questions do you have for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. On the Facebook page, we heard from Janice, who says, I live in Barron County in northwest Wisconsin. I hear retired and elderly people say there isn't enough affordable housing for them. But Janice says it seems housing is high everywhere. Senator Buley, retirees, we want to make it so that people can stay in Wisconsin when they retire, maybe even, fingers crossed, move to Wisconsin to retire. Is this an obstacle?
Well, it is, because of the way that housing for seniors is broken up. If you are of modest means and you are thinking of leaving the farm and want to go into a city, to find a place is going to be difficult. There are, unless you are low income right away, to get a rental would be difficult. A market rate rental is going to be hard to find. And a small home, while it might be affordable, it probably isn't going to be ready for a couple to move into. It might need work. And the ones that are really nice are going to go very, very quickly. There's a housing shortage in most parts of northern Wisconsin. So what we need to do is try to figure out a way to leverage the asset of their home into some sort of a down payment or reinvestment into a project that they're going to be excited about living in. And maybe, if we plan it right, a place that they can continue to age in and get services brought in to them so that they don't have to keep moving depending upon their abilities.
We've got full phone lines. I want to bring on some callers now. Patty is with us in Birchwood. Patty, hi.
Hi. Yes, I do agree that zoning laws are archaic. We were trying to find a house that allowed my sister to live in one part of it in an apartment, and then my parents, elderly parents, in another. And we were looking at houses where we would make an apartment in the house, and there were zoning restrictions on that. So, yes, those laws are archaic. But this issue is nationwide, and I truly believe with the discrepancy in wealth in this country, I think that's one of the problems. And if we actually had a living wage for people, I don't think it would be a difficult problem to solve. And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks for that call, Representative Allen. Some people have said, okay, this is partly a cost of housing problem. This is also partly an income disparity problem, as Patty was making the case there.
Well, as with any market, you've got supply and you've got demand. And when we talked about the retiree situation earlier, one of the problems is that that we're having in Waukesha County is a lot of folks have they're empty nesters, their kids are grown, they've moved out of the house, and they don't want to leave the community. So they stay in their house. The trouble is if there's not any new housing coming in, then there's some housing options for them as retirees, maybe apartment buildings. A lot of communities look negatively about retirement about apartment buildings, but yet that's where the retirees would move to. If you built an apartment in their community, they'd move to that apartment. That would open up the single-family home for that younger family moving in. So a lot of times we just have to look at it from a supply and demand standpoint. Sometimes we need to increase the supply of overall supply of housing to bring those prices down. The challenge sometimes when we say, well, it's a wage issue or an income issue, that's, you know, we all have income problems. Everybody's got an income problem. And because there's never enough. And the trouble is when the wages increase, that increases demand. That also drives prices up. So there's always a disequilibrium in the marketplace. And I think, you know, when you asked earlier, what's the state's role? The state can facilitate that by encouraging kind of a workforce housing development, working with the locals to encourage that. But the locals have to be cognizant of what's happening in their local market and making sure they're meeting the housing demand that's needed at the time.
Patty, thanks for the call. Danny joins us next in Marinette. Danny, hello.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, I got a thing about price gouging by landlords. We have Marinette Marine up here in the city of Marinette, and they bring in all these contractors that make big money. And I've seen ads in the paper where apartments one week were like $300, $400 for a one-bedroom apartment, and now the contractors are in town looking for places to live. They're shooting the rent rates up to like $700, $800 just for a one-bedroom apartment. And none of these kids around here can afford that. They're coming out of school, and they're doubling up with each other just to afford to live in a place.
Danny, thanks a lot for that call. And this is a story we hear around the country, Senator Buley, a great economic success. San Francisco, Portland, you name it, but that drives up costs and it makes a lot of the locals unable to afford a place. Danny says we're seeing it here in Wisconsin, too.
Well, I agree. I think that there's a portion of the people who live in our state who make a very modest wage and who do not have the ability to look forward to getting a big raise, to be changing. They're going to probably stay at that level. And as other circumstances bring in people who can afford a higher rent, they are going to be left behind. And we need, that's exactly the niche that we need to provide. It will not be a huge profit center for a developer. That's just going to be the fact of it. They are eager, if they see the market, to build things that are slick and are going to make a lot of money and are going to satisfy a certain group of people who can afford it. But most of us are middle to lower income and do not anticipate moving up. We just want to stay well. And I think it is up to the state to examine very carefully what are the pressures, why aren't the developers coming in to do these modest developments, and see if there's a way that we can expedite that or at least find a way to make it easier for them.
Thanks, Danny, for the call. We're talking about affordable housing in Wisconsin with State Senator Janet Buley, State Representative Scott Allen. Back to your calls now. Craig joins us in Menominee. Craig, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What'd you want to bring up, Craig?
So it's kind of going off of what your most recent caller was saying about the younger students coming out of college, and it's hard to find affordable housing. But I'll add another factor to that. I'm in that situation, but I'm also married. So in my situation, it would be really weird to try to find other people, I think, to get to room with us to make rent cheaper. And it's also hard to find affordable housing that, you know, up to code. A lot of the stuff that we looked at earlier when we were trying to find our apartment, you know, the sinks and the toilets, everything needed to be replaced. You could tell it was like 30 years old.
Craig, thanks a lot for sharing your story. I appreciate that. We've got a couple minutes left, and I want to take it from where Craig was there, Representative Allen, Senator Buley, to economic development. It's Wisconsin's Housing and Economic Development Authority. If young people like Craig just out of college can't find a place to live, does that hurt Wisconsin's economy, Representative Allen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have to house the workforce to be able to grow. And we have employers in Waukesha County that are starving for employees, and they can't attract them because housing prices are just out of control in Waukesha County. So it hinders their economic growth. Then they have to look at neighboring states or neighboring counties, and they have to look at – and it's very costly for them to expand or to move or to open up a second location. They'd much rather grow internally where they're located. And so housing is an important issue.
Thanks a lot for that call, Craig. Senator Buley, as we start to wrap up, zoning reform isn't always the sexiest topic for the public, I don't think. Do you feel a sense of urgency, though, when you hear stories like the ones we heard from our callers?
I think that zoning reform can be a component, but I don't think it's going to be the silver bullet. We have to look at multiple things from the ground in terms of the regulations all the way through the kinds of ways that we can incentivize developers and make the rents or the home payments more available for low to middle income people. Some of the things that we do sort of like, for example, the previous caller said that the rental properties are not good. Most communities do not have any rental ordinances or the ability to enforce them. If they have them, they're complaint-driven. They're not rather go out and inspect. And therefore, the rental units are subpar.
I want to thank all of our callers, and that flew on by. We'll maybe have you back again to talk about these issues. Senator Buley, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. And do ask me back. I'll come.
Representative Allen, thanks for coming up.
It's been a pleasure.
Been talking to Democratic State Senator Janet Buley from Ashland and Republican Representative Scott Allen from Waukesha looking at affordable housing in Wisconsin. You can keep this conversation going on over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about why U.S. ambassadors are often unqualified when compared to their international counterparts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, during the shooting at Oshkosh High School last week, one student led classmates to safety by letting them into her mosque. We'll get her firsthand account. First, let's go back to President Trump's impeachment inquiry hearings in the House Intelligence Committee last month. We'll talk about the actual impeachment process later today. But some observers have pointed out that the testimony of Trump's ambassador to the European Union may highlight a problem that began many administrations ago, unqualified diplomats. Here's Ambassador Gordon Sondland.
As ambassador, I've had hundreds of meetings and calls with individuals, but I'm not a note taker or a memo writer. Never have been. My job requires that I speak with heads of state, senior government officials, members of the cabinet, the president, almost each and every day. Talking with foreign leaders might be memorable to some people, but this is my job. I do it all the time.
Sondland is a wealthy hotel owner on the West Coast who donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee. Our guest says this kind of pay-to-play arrangement is nothing new, although President Trump may have taken it to a new level. Ryan Scoville is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. He specializes in international and U.S. foreign relations law. He researched the credentials of U.S. ambassadors earlier this year in a paper for the Duke Law Journal. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, Gordon Sondland is just one recent example, but there's a long history of non-diplomatic diplomats getting these ambassadorial posts. But you tackled this. You tried to figure out the numbers. What did you try to figure out in your research here?
Yeah, so I looked at a few things. First, I tried to examine the commonality of these sorts of ambassadors over the course of U.S. history. And in that regard, I found that political appointees have been common ever since the 19th century. And they, in fact, were the majority up through the Franklin Roosevelt administration. They only really dropped to the level that we see today, which is approximately 30% of all ambassadorships with the Truman administration. So this has been a longstanding feature of U.S. Diplomacy. The second thing I found was that although political appointees have been basically, they've had the same commonality over the last several decades since Truman, the qualifications of these individuals have gradually eroded. So the typical appointee under President Reagan, for example, even if we're looking exclusively at political appointees, is not the same as the average political appointee under Trump. If we were to look at language abilities, for example, the average political appointee under Trump is inferior to the average political appointee under Reagan. And the same is true if we look at regional experience, prior experience in the receiving state to which they're sent, and also prior experience in foreign policy and organizational leadership. So today's political appointee is not the same as the political appointee of decades past.
And
the third...
Go ahead.
Well, the third finding was that these political appointees whose credentials have been eroding are donating much larger sums of money to nominating presidents. Again, comparing Trump and Reagan, even after adjusting for inflation, there's been a nearly 1,400% increase in the average size of the campaign contributions over the course of the last several decades.
Is it necessarily true that somebody coming in from outside of the diplomatic system as a donor, a business person, whatever, is going to do a worse job than somebody who came up through the U.S. Foreign Service?
No, I don't think it's necessarily the case. And in fact, if you look at modern U.S. diplomatic history, there are a number of examples of individuals who have come from outside the Foreign Service who nevertheless excelled in the office of ambassador. That said, I think it's quite plausible and even likely that individuals who lack the typical credentials will tend to be inferior in terms of performance to those who served their entire careers in diplomacy.
Now, since the Reagan era, have we seen examples of, fairly big money donors with low qualifications as a bipartisan event? Either party's president might do something like this.
Yeah, it's been common regardless of what type of presidential administration we're talking about. These sorts of nominees were common under Obama. They were common under Reagan. They were common under Clinton. And they're certainly common under Trump today. One thing that is a little bit different under Trump, however, is that although the percentage of political appointees was roughly 30% of all ambassadors from Truman all the way through Obama, under Trump, these sorts of ambassadors had become a little bit more common. Rather than 30%, political appointees now make up a little over 40%. So there's been a 10 to 15% increase in the commonality of these sorts of ambassadors just in the first several years of the Trump administration. Whether that will hold true throughout the course of his administration is unclear, but at the moment that it seems to be the case that the president has a somewhat stronger preference for this sort of appointee.
Does it matter where these ambassadors are doing their jobs? Is it okay maybe if the less qualified ones get what we might view as a cushy appointment in a non-controversial place versus somebody where we need some really good ambassadoring going on?
Yeah, I think there's a good case to be made that it does matter where they get sent. And it's certainly true that sometimes these sorts of appointees are sent to countries that the United States does not have particularly important bilateral relationships with. So sometimes you'll see political appointees get sent to the Bahamas or Fiji. Clearly, the geopolitical stakes are not terribly high in those particular contexts. At the same time, we also send political appointees to Japan, France, Italy, and under Trump, even countries in the Middle East like the United Arab Emirates. So it's certainly the case that our bilateral relationships with those countries are quite significant, whether we're looking at military issues or economic ties or otherwise. So I don't think that this is a practice that is limited exclusively to bilateral relationships that are sort of trivial or not as significant as some of the others.
And for people who don't follow foreign service and foreign relations that closely, you know, we see a president on the TV screen, we see the Secretary of State maybe. How important is the ambassador?
There's a good case to be made that ambassadors remain important. I think there have been a number of authors who have made the argument that ambassadors' importance has diminished in recent decades, in part because the advent of various communications technologies, transportation technologies have made it easier for higher ranking officials in Washington to manage relationships with foreign governments, easier than it used to be anyway. Some have also made the argument that ambassadors are less important than they used to be, given the increasingly specialized and technical nature of foreign relations. The argument here is that given the expertise that is often required, ambassadors who are diplomatic generalists often are not as well positioned to contribute. But all that said, it's certainly the case that ambassadors, as a matter of law, retain substantial and even increasing authority in a number of ways. So for example, the ambassador remains the chief administrator, manager, supervisor of all of the embassy staff. In many cases, these staff number in the hundreds. And certainly it's hard to make the argument that it doesn't matter who is supervising and directing all these individuals. Ambassadors play a very important managerial role. And, you know, they also retain important diplomatic functions that they've always had. So ambassadors today still participate in treaty negotiations. They still engage in the promotion of U.S. goods and services to foreign governments. They still attend diplomatic conferences. They still promote democracy and engage in various other efforts to advance U.S. national interests. So I think that, you know, ambassadors are certainly not the single most important officials in U.S. foreign policy. Certainly the president and the secretary of state are more important. Their powers and their duties are more serious. But at the same time, ambassadors play a very important role in making sure that U.S. foreign relations are carried out in an effective manner.
Talking to Ryan Scoville from Marquette University Law School about U.S. ambassadors, how many of them are political appointees, often political donors, and the impact that has on America's foreign policy. Ryan, before we get to some of the solutions and fixes you offer in your piece that we're talking about, is this common? Do other countries do it this way?
Yeah, so it's not particularly common among advanced democracies. So if you look at Japan, for example, or a number of countries in Western Europe, the standard practice there is to rely exclusively on professional diplomats to serve as ambassadors. On the other hand, there are a number of developing countries that have practices similar to that of the United States, practices whereby they don't rely exclusively on merit or exclusively on professional diplomats to serve as ambassadors. So it's sort of a mixed bag. What the United States does is not totally unprecedented, but it's sort of abnormal for advanced democracies.
And people might assume, Ryan, hey, this is a job that the president gets to appoint, so president gets to do this and there's not much we can do about it. You say in your piece that's not necessarily so.
Yeah, I think there are a number of things that Congress could do. So one is, I think the most straightforward solution would be for the Senate simply to be more exacting in its review of ambassadorial nominees, and for the Senate to essentially turn down nominees whose qualifications seem unlikely to foreshadow an effective time in office. There's been a longstanding tradition of the Senate giving extreme deference to the president on these sorts of nominations. I think the historical average is that the Senate only turns down roughly 3% of ambassadorial nominations. If the Senate really wanted to improve matters, it could certainly scrutinize more carefully and reject a higher percentage. So that's the more straightforward solution. Somewhat more complicated solutions also exist, however. So, for example, if Congress wanted to, I think there's a good case to be made that they could pass a statute that regulates the qualifications of nominees such that the president lacks authority to make a nomination if an individual, for example, has never had has no prior experience in foreign policy or has made campaign donations in excess of a certain sum. Some would, I think, contest the constitutionality of that sort of legislation, but this is a debated issue. And in my view, it's one that leaves more room for Congress to intervene than some would otherwise suggest. On top of that, there are also statutory transparency measures. So, for example, at the moment, it's a little bit difficult for members of the public to figure out precisely how much nominees have donated to the presidents who nominate them. Congress could improve transparency in that regard by mandating aggregate information on the dollar values of the campaign contributions that come from nominees and then publish that information, for example, on the State Department's website. Congress could also mandate more clear information about qualifications so that members of the media and members of the public could quickly look up the qualifications of individuals and compare those qualifications to the amount of money that has been donated. And in turn, draw inferences about whether or not money is playing an undue role in this appointments process.
In our last few moments, Roy, I wanted to ask, a lot of people in Congress might be happy to do this for a president from the opposite party, but not their own party. Are you hopeful in just 30 seconds or so that any of these solutions might actually be taken seriously in Congress?
Well, I'm not totally lacking in hope, but I'm not particularly optimistic. There's been discussions about reform in this area for a long time, ever since at least Watergate, but Congress hasn't really done anything. I think part of the reason is that members of Congress themselves receive substantial campaign contributions from these very same nominees. So I'm not too optimistic, unfortunately.
Ryan, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
That's Ryan Scoville, associate professor at Marquette University Law School. He specializes in international and U.S. foreign relations law. We talked to him about his research into why U.S. ambassadors are often unqualified or underqualified, why many of them, often about 30% in recent years, maybe an uptick in the last couple of years, are not coming out of the Foreign Service, but are often political donors to the president and or the president's party. He published a paper in the Duke Law Journal on this topic. Coming up, we hear from a student at Oshkosh West High School who led students to safety last week when there was a shooting at her school. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to two journalists who are part of a team looking at the role race has played in the war on drugs, from crack cocaine and law enforcement in the 1980s to the opioid problems today that now get a more treatment-focused approach. Now, shootings at schools in both Waukesha and Oshkosh last week thankfully did not result in any loss of life. At Oshkosh West High School, student Dua Ahmad made the decision as the chaos was unfolding that she needed to get out of the school and to help classmates find shelter. Ahmad led more than 100 students with her into a nearby mosque where she worships. Dua Ahmad joins us now. Dua, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry that you had to go through this. How are you feeling now?
I'm feeling all right. We've had the weekend to process the whole situation. Of course, time is best medicine in this case. So, yeah, I'm doing all right now.
And have you all been back to school yet?
Yeah, most of us are back to school. After the weekend, it was a lot of time to process it and everything. So, yeah, we're back to school now.
Well, take us back to that day, what you were doing when you realized something was happening at your school.
Well, first of all, we were in our AP English Literature class when we heard a gunshot. And my teacher, all he instructed us to do was to run. So we ran out of the nearest exit, which happened to be right in front of the mosque. And one of the students running out of that exit as well also said, everybody run to the mosque. So as everybody is going there, of course, the door is locked and you need to enter a code to open it. So knowing that, I just entered the code and I try to let as many people in as possible.
Now, a lot of people have seen the video online, you opening up the mosque and then holding the door and waving people on in. What was that like in that moment, not knowing really what was going on in your school?
Yeah, I mean, the first time when I was opening the door, that was the first time I could actually stand and process everything. And it just started to hit that something was going on. We were all so, so terrified. It was the fact that we didn't know caused a lot of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Had you done Code Red drills, or people call them different things, but drills for situations like this?
Yeah, we've done a few drills. We've done like we've talked about what to do in situations of like a lockdown, of barricading the doors and stuff. And we've also done like Alice training. And towards the beginning of the year-ish, we do evacuation drills where we all line around like the football field.
And as you said, it was chaotic, especially on the way over to the mosque. Did you worry that this was the worst case, that this might be one of the active shooter situations that we've seen in other schools?
Yeah, I mean, in that situation, since you don't know what's going on, of course, your mind instantly goes to the worst case possible. So that's all that was racing through my head when we had finally settled down in the mosque. A bunch of people were saying, like, what's going on? Was it a shooting?
And what was your thought as you opened up the mosque, just that this would be a safer space than just being outside?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even my idea to go to the mosque. It was one of the kids in my school. So since everybody was going that way, I just thought that the most sensible thing was to let everybody in.
And then once you got everybody in, what did you do next?
Well, I instantly got in and called my dad, and I told him, we were just told to evacuate. We don't know what's going on. And he just said, all right, I'm coming with a couple other members of the mosque. And when the teachers instantly took it from there, which was greatly appreciated, we tried to organize by our classes, spread out a little bit, and kind of started to get a little calmer from there. And my dad came as well, and he tried to organize everything.
How long was it before you found out that it was safe now at your school?
Probably when we all went to, well, not me, but when all of my classmates went to the nearby middle school, Tipler, where the rest of the students were. That's because the fact that they were able to move from this location kind of seemed that everything was sort of calming down at that moment.
Now, as I said, the videos out there, a lot of people online anyway, have praised you for being clear-headed, for finding a safe place for your classmates. You don't seem to think of yourself as having done anything special here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just did what anybody would. I mean, the most sensible thing in that situation was to enter the code, of course, and then keeping the door open. I mean, in case the door had gotten shut, that would have been even more chaotic and the situation just would have been worse. So, yeah, I just did what anybody else would in that situation.
You've done drills before, you said. Is it on your mind? Was it on your mind even before this? What happens if something happens? Had you thought through, outside of the drills, what you would do in a situation like this?
Yeah, we've always thought about what we would do, just like, you know, if somebody bad came inside of our classrooms, you would, you know, throw something, et cetera, how we would barricade the doors and, like, just running out and stuff. We've all thought about that.
And well, now it's Monday after this event. As you said, people have gone back to school now. As you talk to your classmates, what do you talk about after last week's events?
I mean, we're trying to just kind of go back to normal, and we just talked about, I've asked other people about their experiences, because some people were in a lockdown, some people had to evacuate, some people went to another location entirely. So we've just kind of talked about that and how it's very scary, and we just hope everybody's doing all right.
What would you say to students at other schools who fortunately haven't been through this experience?
Just that haven't been in this situation?
Yeah.
I guess just take your drills seriously, because you never know what's going to happen, but hopefully it never does happen.
And do you feel anxious at school now, having been through this?
I mean, there is a lot of security, and the administration's taking this very seriously, which I'm, of course, very grateful for. Of course, it's natural for me to feel a little anxious when I do go to school now, though.
And apart from this, you know, you're coming to the end of a semester. How's your school year going?
It's going pretty well. Classes are just resuming normally now after the incident, of course, and we're still a little shaken, and classes are the schedule is a little different now, but just Yeah.
We'll do it. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and best to you and your classmates.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Dua Ahmad, a student at Oshkosh West High School. I talked to her yesterday about the shooting and stabbing at her school that happened last week and how she led classmates to safety inside the nearby mosque where she worships. You can find more information about last week's string of incidents and threats at schools around Wisconsin in WPR.org's archives. We talked to a reporter about the various 8 or 10 incidents at schools around the state. Again, that's at WPR.org. It's the holiday season. That means lots of cookies, of course, but there's a lot of holiday-themed candy out there. Some of it good, some less so. The website candystore.com did a survey, I think, of 11,000 people or so to find out the worst holiday candies of the season. J. Carlisle Larson has opinions often counter to those of the public. Hey, JC.
Yeah, they certainly did not talk to me about this because I have, as you said, some strong and typically, I guess, wrong opinions when it comes to holiday candy.
Let's start with the worst and get as far as we can. We'll get your opinions, okay?
Okay.
Lightning
round.
Christmas tree nougat, those little squishy things.
Very
with a picture
pro.
Of a tree.
Give them
you
to
like
me.
Those. They're
yes, I'll eat them. Yes.
Bizarre and disturbing. Chocolate covered cherry cordial, sickly sweet.
This is my, actually, of all of the ones that were kind of dragged through the mud, my favorite. I love these. I associate them very much with my grandmother. But even without her, I would be extremely into them.
Second worst on the list. They revolt me to think about them. When I eat them, I love them. So there we are. Reindeer corn. Like, it's candy corn, but reindeer themed, I guess. I didn't even know about this.
You know, I'm not familiar, but would also eat that.
I think of Peeps as Easter. Peeps are fourth worst.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas Peeps, I
guess.
Christmas
Peeps exist. I remember them having gingerbread Peeps and also really liking those.
Let's jump down. Number 8, old-fashioned hard candy mix. That takes me back to my great aunt who had bowls of them around at Christmas.
Those I'm a little less on board with, but I will clearly eat them.
Candy news you can use. This is Central Time.